Hello there, I'm Brian Taylor. Down the years, you may have seen me on the telly or heard me on the wireless, but this is different. This is the Brian Taylor podcast, brought to you by The Herald. I'm speaking to the party leaders, challenging them on their policies, their strategies. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you may even vote.
Scotland's recovery should be in Scotland's hands.
Our focus is on Scotland. So the Nationalists focus on separation.
We're going to be asking people in Scotland to vote like our future depends on it, because it really does.
Independence would be like Brexit on a rocket to Mars.
Everything that ALBA does in this election will be a positive contribution to building that independence supermajority.
We can choose to focus on what unites us as a country, not what divides us.
Today we're talking to Anas Sarwar, the leader of Scottish Labour. Want to hear about tax, spending and socialism? You'll catch it all here. Absolutely delighted to be joined today by Anas Sarwar, the leader of the Scottish Labour Party. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
My pleasure, Brian. It's good to see you again.
Let's start with the issue that's dominating everything, of course, the pandemic. But given that this is an election talking about future plans, what is your plan? What is Labour's plan for Scottish economic and maybe social recovery post-pandemic? How do we get out of this?
So I think it's a really important question, Brian, because I think for a lot of people, they view the challenge around COVID as ending when lockdown ends or when the virus hopefully one day disappears.
Yeah.
I think we've got to be much more upfront about this. This is going to take much longer than just the virus disappearing. We are going to have an aftermath that is going to risk our economy, people's jobs, wider health and well-being. And that's why I want us to focus on a national recovery plan and make that our only priority going into the next parliament. And a key part of that national priority and that national recovery has to be a jobs recovery. And I outlined some proposals on that just yesterday.
Yeah.
The most ambitious and biggest job creation scheme in the history of the Scottish Parliament. And that's recognising that we can't have a lost generation coming through COVID.
Yeah.
And if we don't take the appropriate action, it means businesses shutting down, hundreds of thousands of people being unemployed, and us having a stagnant economy. I don't want that to happen. I want us to instead use this as an opportunity to reshape our economy, to guarantee a job for anyone that wants one, to have a reskilling revolution across the country, an apprenticeship revolution across the country, to make sure everyone gets not just a first chance, but actually people deserve a second and third chance too.
Let's talk about that. You're talking about a £1 billion jobs recovery plan. We'll talk in a minute about the cost of that. But you know, you're talking about a job or training guarantee for the unemployed and for young Scots, admirable objectives. But you know, these sort of things have been tried in the past. I know you'll say it's a far bigger programme, but they have been tried in the past. Is this not just, you know, YTS by another name?
No. It's bigger than that. So the jobs guarantee scheme, that there's two jobs guarantee schemes in the past. One is the jobs guarantee scheme as we came through the banking crisis, which was targeted at young people, which is focused mainly in the public sector and the voluntary sector. You then also have a Scottish Government jobs guarantee scheme, which is only really support around 18,000 people. I think we need to be much more ambitious than that. So the jobs guarantee scheme I'm talking about is for people under 25, but also the long-term unemployed, getting people back to work and doing it in a way that recognises the new economic environment we'll face going forward. Alongside that, it's 5,000 apprenticeships.
Yes.
And those apprenticeships, I think it's really important to note that the rate of pay for apprenticeships is woefully, woefully low. So this is around almost doubling the pay of apprenticeships, making them much more attractive thing that someone wants to go into,
yeah,
and therefore reskilling and being able to go much long term into the economy. Alongside that, Brian, which is the reskilling part, which is so important, is you've got 360,000 people on furlough at the moment in Scotland. And some of them will be going back to the jobs that they're currently furloughed from. But not everyone will be going back to those jobs. And some of them will be worried about if and when they'll have work to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
And I want us to create a £500 fund for each of those individuals, which is not a cash supplement. It is an access to a pot of money that they can draw down in order to do new skills training. That allows them to learn those new skills, hopefully go back into the job they're doing, or if they're unfortunate enough to lose that job, they're able to learn that new skill to go into an alternative form.
But I mean, I'll come to that question of pay in a second. But you know, talking about the broad strategy here, don't we need economic growth rather than these programs that you're talking about? You know, a report for
they're connected, Brian.
A report for Sir Tom Hunter's Foundation from Oxford Economics points that Scotland's economic output per head is 75% of comparable size Denmark. He says that the tax system we have is not at all encouraging work, savings or investment. Scottish Chambers of Commerce say that you need a rally for growth. You need growth, rather than schemes that working within the system radical change.
Sir Tom Hunter is right, and the Chamber of Commerce is right. And alongside growth, we have to create jobs. Uh-huh. And the way we create growth is not by sucking life out of businesses and having mass unemployment. The way we create growth is by protecting jobs, by protecting businesses, by creating new businesses so we can have economic output, which in itself helps create jobs, it helps to widen the tax base, and to help increase growth across the country. And the danger we have at the moment is if we do not take the urgent action alongside a growth crisis, we would then have an unemployment crisis,
yes,
companies going bust crisis, and then a crisis in terms of our public sector finances because you're reducing the tax base and therefore not able to do all the ambitions we want.
But if you talk about...
Absolutely right. We've got to focus on growth.
Yeah, but you talk about
investing in industries and creating jobs.
You talk about public spending there. If public spending, do you accept there is a balance? There's a point at which if public spending becomes so high, so out of control, I'm not suggesting it is, but if that were to be the case, then you end up with a tax burden that is so high that you cannot have the investment from companies as you're describing there, and those companies go to the wall.
Look, it's got to be a balance. The challenge you have is unless we invest, we can't grow. And if we choke off investment into businesses and into work programs, then you will mean more businesses going bust and a stagnation of growth rather than expansion of growth. And I think that's the big challenge for us. So you've seen big interventionist policies from the UK government around the furlough scheme, for example. Uh-huh. We've had lots of pots of monies announced for support during the pandemic. If that is choked off, so if that support ends too quickly or we have a cliff edge on furlough, you will then have businesses going bust, people losing their jobs and stagnation of growth. We've got to recognise that it's going to take time for businesses to get back to pre-COVID levels. So we've got to continue that transitional tapered support for those businesses.
But it's going to take time as well for the economy to get back to pre-crisis. Yes. It's not just the pandemic. We're still recovering from the economic crash of 2008. And from you, Mr. Sarwar, I am hearing umpteen pledges to spend millions of pounds, even billions. I'm not hearing about the savings that will be needed because of that pandemic and because of recovering from that crash of 2008.
But to be clear about the billions, one point is you mentioned the banking crisis. COVID has been a sharper and deeper hit than the banking crisis.
Yeah.
And it's taken
really bigger savings.
It has taken 10 years for us to recover from that. And I would caution about how we mix savings and what we talk about investment. So if someone was to say we could have saved 6 billion over the last year by not doing furlough in Scotland, that might have been a saving in terms of not spending to save people's jobs, but it would have decimated our economy, even more so than the pandemic already has, decimated our economy, and hundreds of thousands of people would have been unemployed across.
But look at the figures coming from the Office for National Statistics, and they apply to Scotland as well. They apply to the UK. You have record borrowing at the highest level since monthly records began, and tax receipts at the lowest level over a long period as well. That cannot continue.
Yeah, but how do you balance public spending? You balance public spending in three ways. One is you can follow a cuts agenda, an austerity agenda. I think that would have a detrimental approach because your cuts and your austerity agenda would undermine what you're trying to do in terms of intervention in the economy and undermine our ability to spend on public services. The second part is tax increases. I think there will be a place and a time for tax increases, particularly around corporation tax increases for those companies that have been winners through this pandemic. For example, Amazon and others. So there'll be a place for tax increases on companies like Amazon. And the third part in terms of closing that deficit is growth. So I completely agree with Sir Tom Hunter's assessment that we need to have a growth across our country. But in order to get that growth, we have to invest in our economy. And you make the point about billions of pounds.
Yeah.
This is not new money. I think it's important to emphasise that. This is not billions of pounds of new money we need to find. There is an IFS report recently showed that there are billions of pounds of unallocated non-recurring money, but also unallocated recurring money in the Scottish budget that is yet not being used. We should be using those billions of pounds to focus on a national recovery, to get us back on track and to get our economy going again.
But your rivals would say that's money that's put by for still more difficult days perhaps to come. But let me pick up on your tax point. Corporation tax, you talked about increases there. Corporation tax, of course, not currently in the control of the Scottish Parliament. But income tax is. Income tax most certainly is. Rates and bands entirely determined by MSPs for Scotland. What would you do with income tax? What would be your approach to income tax? Would you levy more?
I have always favoured more progressive taxation, but I would put two caveats on that. One, we have billions of pounds of unallocated money. We should be using, rather than a presumption of tax increases, we should be using those billions of pounds to invest in the recovery to get our country back on track. Secondly, we've got to balance any tax increases with what they mean for the recovery and the impact that has in terms of people's household incomes, but also choking off any potential recovery as well. And the third part is, I think there is a suite of taxes we can look at that do not look just at income taxes. And one part of that is we should have cooperation in Scotland and across the UK, indeed across the world, where we're taxing the winners of this pandemic. I hate using the word winners.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to think anyone's won through the pandemic.
Yeah.
Okay. But companies like Amazon have made extraordinary profits through this pandemic, and you've seen high streets pay a price as a result. We should have fairer taxation around that to make it.
But you've made that point. But on income tax, you talk about progressive taxation. That means that those with the broader shoulders economically paying more in Scotland perhaps than in the UK as a whole. Are you in favour of that? As I understand, of course, you'll give us the details, but are you in favour of that as a principle?
As a principle, I favour more progressive taxation. We have to look at timing and we have to look at approach. And I think we have billions of pounds available that we should be spending in the first instance to do all the things we want to do.
That's money saved for a rainy day. If you spend that, you don't have the reserves for still worse times.
Brian, what rainy day are we waiting for? We are living rainy days. We are in the midst of the rainy days. We are not in a period of sunshine and let's fix the roof while the sun is shining. We are in the midst of a national emergency and crisis. So if we have billions of pounds of unallocated money, if we're not going to spend it now to focus on national recovery, what are we waiting for?
Okay, you mentioned earlier the issue of tackling low pay by ensuring apprentices, etc., get extra cash. Now, there are some companies that find it difficult to meet these targets, difficult to meet the real living wage and still return a profit. Your own family firm has found it difficult to meet that real living wage objective and still return a profit. Isn't that going to cause problems for the economic sector?
Look, the way we do it is, one is the legal framework, and I support us having a devolution of employment law with a floor across the UK, but we have a race to the top, not a race to the bottom. Second is making sure we're engaging trade unions into workplaces. I think that's really important. Third, we've got to recognise there's over 300,000 people in Scotland who are working and not earning the living wage. That is partly because there are huge issues in individual sectors. So how do we encourage sectoral bargaining and create the environment in individual sectors where people aren't undercutting each other within a sector in order to compete so we can have sectoral support? And the other way is how do we project best practice by using the public sector? So anybody that has access to public sector grants, they should be conditional on those public sector grants on basic conditions around pay, basic conditions around conditions, about conditions for workers, but also around their carbon neutral objectives and also their community benefit.
I don't want to make much of this, but isn't it faintly embarrassing for you that your own family firm has not paid the real living wage?
No, I mean, they have a relationship with trade union USDA, so they have a very good working relationship with USDA as their recognised trade union. They are working with USDA to resolve many of the issues that the sector has. Mm-hmm. And that's why we need sectoral bargaining, because that sector in particular has a particular issue around this. So we need sectoral bargaining so there is a level playing field for people across the sector. I'm an NHS dentist, Brian. I chose a different route. I've never worked in a family business or a family company. I chose to become an NHS dentist. I've chosen to dedicate my life to public service. And a key part of dedicating myself to public service is making sure we build a fairer and more equal society. And one part of doing that is making sure we have an economy that works for everyone. That means the right legal framework. It means the right conditions within a sector. That's why sectoral bargaining is important. It means a strong relationship with trade unions and seeing our economic growth package as a relationship between the public sector, the voluntary sector, the private sector, and our trade unions. That's the kind of economic model I want us to pursue.
We've talked about the economic consequences of the pandemic. Let's talk about the pandemic itself. Do you believe that Nicola Sturgeon has worked hard? She says she's worked tirelessly. Do you believe she's worked hard to combat that pandemic?
Look, credit where credit is due. And I said this in the TV debate last week, that Nicola Sturgeon has attempted to lead from the front. She has communicated a lot better in this pandemic than Boris Johnson has. Some might argue that's a low bar, but she has been on the front foot in terms of communicating, and I think that's welcome. But I think on some of the big issues, she has made the same mistakes as the UK government, and in the case of care homes, made worse mistakes. And I think we need to learn from those mistakes going forward. We should never have been sending COVID-positive patients into care homes. That didn't require medical guidance. That required common sense. We should be much quicker around support around PPE for frontline workers. Our testing capacity rate was far too slow, particularly in terms of peak areas. And there was a long time where the government said we couldn't take action around testing at airports and we couldn't do quarantining because it was a UK-wide framework. But then we found the ability to do it 10 months into the pandemic. We could have done that much earlier.
Would you agree that the overall cautious approach she has taken has been borne out, endorsed by the fact that they took a different approach elsewhere in Europe, and we are now seeing big increases in countries like Germany, France, and Italy?
I think it's right to take a cautious approach, but I would say that 10,000 of our citizens have lost their lives in Scotland due to COVID. That is one of the poorest rates in Europe. We have the second worst care home death rate in Europe. In Scotland, I'm talking about the second worst care home death rate in Europe. So whilst there's things that we have done right, we have got some major, major things wrong. And I don't think we should shy away from being honest about that. So yes, she's put in the energy, and I give her credit for that. Yes, she's attempted to lead from the front, but we have made some serious mistakes that have resulted in too many of our fellow citizens losing their lives.
Let's expand that into health and social care generally. Nicola Sturgeon is talking about remobilising the NHS, talking about, you know, increasing the treatment activity beyond the pandemic levels. It's pretty much the same sort of thing as you're talking about. Aren't you slightly trumped by the fact you're planning the same sort of approach?
And she's not right.
Incumbent government is on the case. They're on the job.
Brian, she's not. What she's committing to is to go to 10% above where we were at pre-COVID levels.
Yeah.
She's been in government for 14 years. She's been first minister for 7 years. And in that time, she has broken the treatment time guarantee law 380,000 times. 380,000 times. We have never met our cancer target in the history that it's been there. In the 7 years she's been First Minister, she's never met it. 1,500 children are waiting over a year for mental health support. On 25,000 occasions during this pandemic, someone has picked up the phone to call the crisis mental health helpline, and the call has gone unanswered in a crisis mental health service. That has potentially devastating consequences. So it's very easy to promise that she's going to take action and do things when she's been in government for 14 years, 7 years as First Minister, and frankly, has a record that doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
But it could be said that the NHS, because of the very nature of it being a demand-led service, absorbs pretty well every cash that's given to it, particularly when a huge amount of the money spent in the NHS is on pay. There's been a 4% offer from the Scottish Government, four times what's that offered by the UK Government. A 4% offer to nurses and other NHS staff, and your party welcomed that. Do you still welcome that, or are you backtracking upon that welcome?
No, I welcome any pay increase for our NHS staff. I recognise that there's unions that aren't happy with that level of pay increase. I think there needs to be much greater engagement with them to make sure that we have a fair pay deal for all our NHS staff.
I'm not clear. Do you think the 4% offer is a good deal and should go ahead? Or do you think it should be the 12% that the RCA?
I welcome and support the 4% pay deal, but it's got to be done in partnership with the representative trade unions. Uh-huh. And there is still room for a manoeuvre there around making sure that the trade unions and the employees believe they're being adequately rewarded.
But if you pay 12% and more to the nurses, the other professions and the other areas in the NHS will want the same. And so will the rest of the public sector.
No, I'm coming to the other professions. So whilst I welcome the 4% and advise the government to please work closely with the trade unions to make sure they find a position that the workers can support as well as the government can support, is actually that doesn't go far enough. Care home workers have not been rewarded adequately enough. They've only got a 20 pence uplift. I'm sorry, they're worth more than 20p. We should be paying our care home staff £12 an hour with a view to paying them £15 an hour by the end of the next Parliament, because they have paid the biggest price of this crisis through the care home scandal, through the pandemic. And alongside that, our local government staff, who also deserve a pay rise to recognise the extraordinary work they've done through this pandemic. They were underpaid before the pandemic. That's become even more starker focus beyond this pandemic. But I must pick up one other thing,
yeah,
Brian.
Yeah. Go on.
It is not appropriate for the government to try and hide behind their pay deals for not being able to implement and deliver the service that they promised to deliver to people across Scotland.
I'll be interviewing Nicola Sturgeon, I'm sure, but I'm sure that she would say that's not the case.
Of course she's going to say it's not the case. Doesn't mean it's the truth. Our NHS staff are underpaid, undervalued, and overworked pre the pandemic. That has been exacerbated by the pandemic. So we need to prioritise cancer care in particular. Cancer remains the biggest killer in Scotland. There are 7,000 undiagnosed cancers in the last year. Cancer remains Scotland's biggest killer. We've got to focus on a cancer catch-up plan. Rapid diagnostic centres were promised back in February. We still haven't seen them delivered yet in terms of trying to get a catch-up on our cancer diagnoses. Mental health services, you mentioned budgets. We spend 8% of our NHS spend on mental health capacity and services in Scotland. The rest of the UK average is 11.5%. We've got to, over the course of the next Parliament, try and bridge that gap so we can challenge the mental health pandemic that's going to come up.
I say again, we're hearing expenditure promises, but not the economies that might be necessary, but we've discussed that earlier. Let's talk about education.
The IFS report talks about billions of pounds of unallocated money, Brian.
Do you think the Scottish education system is failing? Do you think it is a failing system?
Look, I don't think it's a failing system, but it's failing too many children. So there are too many children that aren't getting a proper first chance, never mind a second chance in our education system. The attainment gap is continuing to widen, not narrow. There are huge failings we've seen through this pandemic, particularly around the SQA exams fiasco and what that meant for young people. And we once had the one of the best education systems in the world. And I want us to get back to having one of those best education systems in the world. That's why as part of our recovery plan, we've published an education comeback plan, which is about individual assessment for every pupil across the country, including a mental health assessment. It is also giving one-to-one tutoring support for those children that need that extra bit of support. It's about a guaranteed reset for those children in those formative years who, because of the pandemic, may have not got the results they were looking to get into that college or university place, okay, or to that sector they want to go and work in. We should do a guaranteed reset. And I also want us to have a summer comeback pass, because there are young people across the country who, not in those formative years, but those younger age cohorts that missed out on a year of friendships and relationships and interactions.
We should be all that. On the subject of assessment. Forgive me. On the subject of assessment, do you believe in early assessment in the early years? You know, the argument being that it catches problems, and do you believe in a return? It hasn't been possible this year, but do you believe in a return to externally assessed exams by the SQA? Reinstating the hires, for example, when it's possible. Do you believe in those two types of testing?
You mean coming through the pandemic?
Yes, after the pandemic is over.
So after the pandemic, I think we need some fundamental reform of the SQA, because I think there is clearly a breakdown between the relationship with the SQA, the relationship it has with teachers, with head teachers, and also the relationship it has with parents and with pupils. I think there does need to be a fundamental reform of that. Of course, there does need to be some form of examination in order for you know, access to college and university.
Yes.
But I think the focus of what needs to be, I think, coming through this is for those younger age cohorts. In many ways, they have all their life to learn. They have taken a mental health and well-being hit much greater than even an education. And I think that focus needs to be on them being able to rebuild those relationships and supporting them to be able to be relaxed going back into the school environment, hopefully normally after the summer holidays. But for those older age cohorts who have missed out on those formative years, I think they deserve to get that second chance. We cannot afford them to be a lost generation coming through this. And that's why I talk about the free guaranteed reset.
I'm going to talk towards the close about independence, of course, the one of the huge issues at this election. But let's talk a little about you, Mr. Sarwar. You're a relatively new leader. Why was it felt necessary within the Labour Party to oust Richard Leonard? Did Labour lose its way is really the generic question I'm asking.
Well, look, I've been leader for 5 weeks. It feels a lot longer than 5 weeks, but we've come running at it. A big, massive task to do an election campaign just 10 weeks after your election day, just 10 weeks after you've got a result of a leadership election. We're halfway into that, and I think we're making good progress, steady progress. Obviously, I want us to accelerate that progress in the next 4 weeks as we lead up to the election.
I'm not hearing an answer to why Richard Leonard had to be ousted and why Labour lost its way, perhaps. No,
I mean, that's a much broader question. That could take an entire programme, Brian. In terms of, you mentioned Richard, that was obviously a decision for Richard, but in terms of Labour losing its way, look, I'm honest about it. I was honest about it on day one of my leadership. We were at 14% in the opinion polls just 3 days before I became leader. The reality is that the people of Scotland didn't get or didn't have the Labour Party they deserved in recent times. And I am working flat out day and night, not just through this election campaign, but I promise beyond it as well, to give the people of Scotland the Labour Party they deserve.
Do you regard yourself as a socialist?
Absolutely.
Absolutely a socialist in terms of the common ownership of the means of production, distribution and exchange.
I absolutely regard myself as a socialist. I absolutely believe that we need fundamental reform in our economic and social model. And I fundamentally believe that coming through this pandemic, we now have an argument for labour values now more than ever. Our challenge as a political party, though, is to make sure that we root that in the future of Scotland, not in our past. And we don't use the language of the past, but we use the language of the future and look aspirational and represent Scotland's future. I think I do that in more ways than one.
And yet you're a socialist who didn't choose to send your offspring to your local state school.
Yep. Look, that's a fair question, a fair criticism. I never shy away from that. That was a decision that was made by my wife and I together, what we thought was in the best interest of our children. But the reality is there are too many children across our country who don't get opportunity. Our education system needs to be strengthened across Scotland. And that's why we published our education comeback plan. And that's why I'm working with parents and families across the country to get education back on track.
You talked about Labour, you know, to some extent requiring to regroup. Is your real objective in this election to overhaul the Conservatives and regain second place behind the SNP?
So the pathway that I saw for myself when I became leader was, as I say, 14% in the polls, was a pathway from four phases: survival, relevance, credible opposition, credible alternative. Now, I wish I could say to you, Brian, that I can complete all four of those stages in 10 weeks, from the day I was elected to the day of the election. That might be a stretch, but I want us to try and complete three stages of that four-stage process at least. I think we have got the Labour Party back on the pitch. I think people are listening to us again. I think we are getting a resonance of our message. I think we are tapping into a feeling in the country. We need to now translate that into actual votes and support at the election. Mm-hmm. And time is a challenge for me. I accept that, having only been in the job 5 weeks. But we are doing that. I think we are making the right case and a focus for national recovery. And I do want us to come through this election campaign as a credible opposition so we can have a balanced parliament, not a parliament that has too much power in one party so that they are distracted by their number one priority, which the blind spot that Nicola Sturgeon has for the constitution. But also we have a main opposition in Scotland that isn't just seeing politics as a game and just shouting about what they disagree with rather than trying to proactively trying to improve our country. So I think we'd be better than the failing government and the failing opposition. I think Scotland deserves a better government and a better opposition.
Being realistic, you don't expect to be forming that government. You don't expect to be first minister. You expect to be perhaps forming the position as leader of the largest opposition party.
Well, look, I of course I'm arguing for every vote and every seat across the country, but I'm also not naive, and I also believe in honesty and some humility. So it doesn't look like we're going to form a government in 4 weeks' time. That might change. The people of Scotland might change rapidly in that time. It doesn't certainly look that way at the moment, but I do want this to be, as I say, doing that rebuilding job, being a credible opposition, and therefore in the election that follows, I think we can credibly argue for a Labour government and a Labour First Minister.
In the event of a hung parliament again, you know, no party with an overall majority, could you work with other parties? Could you work with the Liberal Democrats? Labour worked with them in the first 8 years of devolution.
So just to be clear, you know, we would not do any coalitions with any political party, but on individual issues, I have a record of working with other political parties. I work with every political party around challenging prejudice and hate in all its forms. On my party, worked with the SNP around the period poverty bill and also the protection of retail workers. My party worked with the Green Party around the SQA exam scandal. We worked with the Liberal Democrats around strengthening mental health services. We worked with the Conservatives around scrapping the Offensive Behaviour at Football Act. So on individual issues, I am, of course, happy to work with anyone. We can try and create a fairer and better Scotland.
But no grand unionist coalition, as the Conservatives have suggested. They suggest that the parties who don't believe in independence should forge together.
I think what Douglas is trying to do there is play a game. And I'm not interested in games. I'm not interested in egos. I think we need a much more civilised politics than that.
Let's talk finally about the issue of independence, the offer of independence from the SNP and from others. Would you rule out there being an independence referendum during the lifetime of the next Scottish Parliament? Would you rule that out entirely?
Yes, I don't support independence. I don't support a referendum. I think the next Parliament should be focused on national recovery, not going back to the old arguments. And that's what I believe, and that's what we're arguing in this election.
You think the Prime Minister, presently Boris Johnson, Keir Starmer of Labour, hoping to occupy that post, hoping to enter Downing Street, you think the Prime Minister should rule out a referendum because the issue of the Constitution remains reserved to Westminster?
Well, look, first of all, it's of course Scotland's right to choose its own future. We are heading towards an election. No one has yet cast a vote. And what I'm not going to do is be a spectator. I'm a participant in the election.
Yes,
sir. Being a participant, I want to persuade people that that is not the right approach for Scotland. I don't think that's the right thing for us to do coming through this pandemic. Instead, I think we should focus on national recovery. And that's what I'm focused on for the next 4 weeks and hopefully the next 5 years of our parliament.
I understand your argument that, you know, you can preempt this by the outcome at the Holyrood elections. But in the event that it isn't preempted by the outcome of the Holyrood elections, do you believe that the UK government, of whatever colour, exercise their power to veto this?
Brian, I'm not going to speculate on the result of the election, but I've always been clear that it's Scotland will choose its own future. I want it to choose an alternative future, which is not going back to the old arguments, not going back to the egos, not going back to the settling of scores, and instead recognising that there are some ideas bigger than those constitutional fights, and getting our country back on track and focusing on national recovery is my only priority.
Your Tory critics will hear that and they will say that you are not ruling out a referendum. They'll say you're again a referendum, you don't want it, it's not your priority, but they won't hear you ruling it out, and they'll say that means that Labour is weak on the issue of independence.
I find the suggestion that somehow I'm weak on these issues or Labour's weak on these issues, frankly, laughable. I'm happy to say it as slowly and as regularly as the Tories need to hear it or the SNP need to hear it. We do not support independence. We do not support another referendum. We think we should do things differently, though, and not go back to those old arguments. At a time of national crisis, this is a pandemic election. The idea that we focus on this election campaign and our next parliament on just shouting those same old tired slogans and having those same old tired fights that are in politicians' own interest but not in the national interest is simply not credible. I think Scotland deserves better than that. And that's why I think Scotland deserves a better government and a better opposition.
The Labour Party, perhaps particularly through Gordon Brown, is looking at alternative ways of distributing power across these islands. Could you see there being further powers coming to the Scottish Parliament, perhaps over the business taxation that we were talking about earlier?
I think if you look throughout this pandemic, you have seen a disconnect from, you know, in Liverpool, Birmingham, Manchester, Cardiff, just like in Glasgow, where I'm sitting just now, and other parts of Scotland, with Boris Johnson, with the Tories. And I think coming through this, if we are going to have a recovery that works for everyone, and we are going to have a recovery that works within Scotland also, north, south, east, west, urban, rural, coastal, island recovery, then we've got to push power out from the parliaments into our local communities. That means pushing power out of Westminster into the nations and regions. But it also crucially means pushing power out of Holyrood into local communities across the country as well. That's the way we deliver a recovery that works for everyone. But we should do that because we believe in devolution. That shouldn't be conditional on a referendum. It shouldn't be conditional or seen as some kind of fixed independence. I believe in devolution. We're a pro-devolution party. If we believe in devolution, we should deliver it.
Anas Sarwar, thank you very much indeed for joining this Herald podcast. Thanks again.
Thank you, Brian.
This podcast was brought to you by The Herald. We're giving you the chance to get exclusive access to even more insight, analysis and opinion with a Herald subscription. Take 20% off an annual rate with the code HeraldNew2021. This offer is for new subscribers only and is only available with the promotional code. Subscriptions will renew at the standard rate unless cancelled. And sign up to our free evening politics newsletter, Unspun, to get snap analysis from some of our top contributors every day. Head to heraldscotland.com for the details. ¶¶
Thank you.